last speaker this morning is Kelly Hall. I don't even. Oh, yeah, she's in there second. Okay, going to be speaking on reproductive autonomy and highly religious women. And Kelly, of course, is the was the winner last night of the Young Investigator Award for the section. So we're doubly pleased to have Kelly here this morning. Anyway, so Dr. Hall's research is broadly focused on adolescent sexual and reproductive health and family planning in the U.S. and Africa. She's particularly interested in the intersections among reproductive health, mental health, physical health across adolescence and young adulthood. Much of her work is focused on how health and well-being, or lack thereof, shape the risk of adolescent unintended pregnancy. She's also focused on how adolescent pregnancy shapes subsequent health and social outcomes across the reproductive health course in both domestic and global context. With a clinical background in nursing, she's interested in integrated models of care and patient-centered health services, community interventions which can currently address reproductive health, family planning, and other dimensions of women's health, including mental health, chronic disease, and social context. Kelly.
I'm really excited to be here to present on behalf of Javi, the first author and primary investigator of this project. She was my family planning fellow at Michigan, and now she's faculty, and she's due with twins any minute, so she said she couldn't be here. We have no disclosures. So here are our learning objectives. This project sought to define reproductive autonomy, and then we measured reproductive autonomy among highly religious women, and then identified differences in reproductive autonomy levels among various religious denominations. So here is one definition of reproductive autonomy. Having reproductive autonomy means that women can control whether and when to become pregnant, whether and when to use contraception, what method to use, and whether and when to continue their pregnancy. So, religiosity and identification in a religious community may impact a woman's reproductive autonomy. Specific religious doctrines or teachings concerning sex, fertility, family planning, childbearing, and relationships may influence a woman's ability to make decisions around reproduction. In addition, identification with a religious community may influence a woman's reproductive autonomy due to conflict between her own reproductive goals and her community's norms and expectations, particularly in communities who have pronatalist tendencies, traditional gender roles, and proscriptions against contraception and abortion. Yet little is known about how reproductive autonomy is experienced among highly religious women. So recently, Dr. Ushma Upadhyay and colleagues from the University of California, San Francisco, developed and validated a scale to measure reproductive autonomy. It's the first and only reproductive autonomy scale of which we are aware. And the scale was based in a range of social science and psychological theory. So here's a diagram of the conceptual framework. So they operationalized reproductive autonomy as having three main concepts: freedom from coercion, communication, and decision-making. So in other words, a woman's level of reproductive autonomy is shaped by her ability to communicate with her partner and others, to have self-efficacy, and to make decisions, and then also counter coercion regarding contraceptive and abortion decisions. So according to their model, having reproductive autonomy is the first step towards being able to use contraception or, on the other hand, avoid unprotected sex, and then subsequently achieving one's fertility intentions and goals. So all of the items in their scale fall into one of these three domains. And they tested and validated the scale in a large sample of reproductive women recruited from family planning in Title 10 clinics across the U.S. And here's what they found. So women who scored higher on two of the three subscales were significantly more likely to avoid unprotected sex, and then the third subscale at the bottom, decision making, although it wasn't statistically significant, it was in the same direction of effect. So sorry for the busy slide. We wanted to give you a sense for the items in Ushma's scale. So you can see that there are a total of 14 items grouped into three different subscales. And the first two subscales, freedom from coercion and communication, were scored on a 4-point Likert scale, so strongly agree to strongly disagree. And then the third subscale, decision making, asks a series of questions about who has the most say in family planning decision making, and includes three options: my partner, or someone else, me and my partner, or just me. So possible scores on this subscale range from 1 to 3. And a higher number on each of the subscales indicates a greater level of reproductive autonomy. So then a total score is developed for each scale, and then we average the three subscale scores together to get the total score. So the purpose of this study, then, was to describe reproductive autonomy among highly religious women using a validated scale that we just described. And we also sought to examine differences across in reproductive autonomy across different religious denominations of highly religious women. So I should say, and she doesn't talk about this in the presentation, but this is part of a much bigger fellowship project that Javi did, integrating religion as one of the domains of the scale. So this was some preliminary descriptive work. So we distributed an online questionnaire that contained the reproductive autonomy scale, along with a series of other reproductive history measures, sociodemographic characteristics, and we used a snowball sampling technique using Facebook, very similar to the previous speaker's approach, and then performed Fisher's exact test and ANOVA to examine differences across religious groups, and then linear regression to account for covariates. So women who were eligible for inclusion in the study were married, English-speaking women between the ages of 18 and 45 years who identified as highly Christian, highly religious Christian, Muslim, or Jewish women. The reason that we decided to focus on these particular communities is, first, although there's been a substantial amount of literature on Christianity and its role in reproductive outcomes, there's very little research on Jewish and Muslim communities. In addition, these communities have strong religious norms that can potentially impact reproductive autonomy. And then we further limited participation to married women because in these communities with strong pronatalist norms, sex and procreation are assumed to be acceptable only within the context of marriage, and therefore married women's experiences may be distinctly different from women in other types of relationships. So then to screen for level of religiosity, we used the Hoag Intrinsic Religious Motivation Scale. So this is a validated scale, two items, which ask women to state their extent to what extent they agree with the following two statements. I try hard to carry my religious beliefs over to all of my dealings in life, and my whole approach to life is based on my religion. So only women who responded strongly agree to each of these items were eligible to participate. So here you can see the baseline characteristics. A total of 513 eligible women completed the survey. So we had mostly Jewish and Catholic respondents, although we did have a number of Protestant and Mormon women as well. Unfortunately, the number of Muslim women participating, which we went to length to get Muslim women to participate, was still too small and not included here. So the average age, as you can see, was 30 years. Almost all women were white and had children already, and over 70% had completed some college or more. So here are the mean scores on the religious autonomy scale. Remember, the scores range from 1 to 4. And we have it broken down by religious denomination. So you can see that there weren't any significant differences in scores across the religious denominations, meaning the scores were similar for Catholic women, Protestant women, and Mormon women. However, Jewish women, surprisingly, had significantly higher scores than any of the other denominations, even after adjusting for age, education, income, and history of sexual abuse. So then we looked specifically at the freedom from coercion subscale. So remember, it included questions about whether a woman had been pressured or forced by her partner to use birth control or to become pregnant when she didn't want to. And so women were asked to state to what extent they agree with the following four statements. My partner has stopped me from using a method to prevent pregnancy when I wanted to use a method. My partner has messed with or made difficult to use a method to prevent pregnancy when I wanted to use one. If I wanted to use a method to prevent pregnancy, my partner would stop me, and my partner has pressured me to become pregnant. So here we see the proportion of women who agreed with these items in the coercion subscale, and so we have the proportion who agreed with at least one item in the subscale, and then we have the proportion of women who agreed with all four items on the subscale. And so you can see for agreement with at least one of the four items, 94% of Catholic women agreed, 81% of Protestant women agreed, and 100% of Mormon women agreed, compared to only 20% of Jewish women. And then for agreement, you can see for agreement with all items, the trends were similar, with the Christian denominations having higher proportions of women who agreed with all statements, and a much smaller proportion of Jewish women. And these differences were significant even in the multivariable models. So there are several important limitations of this study that we wanted to mention. Of course, sampling bias is one of them for all the many strengths that snowballing via Facebook and technology brings with it. It is limited. We don't know the denominator of eligible women here, and certainly our sample was relatively homogenous and not representative of all religions. In fact, some of the religions that we really wanted to target, like Muslim women, in the onset of this study. So ultimately, we have limited generalizability. In addition, self-report and recall bias is always a concern when we were asking women to respond to very sensitive questions about their sexual and reproductive history and experiences, and certainly the stigma, I think, is playing out here too. And then thirdly, the cross-sectional design, of course, precluded any dynamic measure of women's experiences with reproductive autonomy and their religious beliefs. Nonetheless, we have several important take-home messages, we think. So as I said, in our study, Catholic, Protestant, and Mormon women had low levels of reproductive autonomy, particularly when it came to experiencing coercion from their husbands. So approximately 90% of Christian women at some point in the relationship felt that they, as though they were forced by their husbands to try to conceive when they did not want to become pregnant. Jewish women, on the other hand, had higher levels of autonomy, and this is not at all what we hypothesized, and in fact not at all why the study was conducted in the first place. Javi was particularly interested in Jewish women. So the difference here across religious groups may suggest that there's something else beyond just religion itself that influences reproductive autonomy among highly religious women that we haven't identified in this study. So it's possible, for instance, that among various religions, there are different conceptualizations of social and cultural norms that influence gender role beliefs and that may impact women's reproductive autonomy. So ultimately, further research is needed to elucidate this finding and especially how it influences actual rates of unintended pregnancy and then pregnancy outcomes. Thank you.
So if the four speakers could come up, we've got actually a good amount of time for questions. I'd ask you to keep your questions brief so we can hear from the speakers. So let me start by asking Lois, wonderful description of the important work that Merger Watch is doing, and it's very, relatively unique in the policy realm, and it works on a very important issue. So, knowing the information about these mergers and the systematic efforts to identify hospitals that are about to merge, what should we say the push points, the sensitivity points with hospitals? I mean, my experience is hospitals don't want to be embarrassed in public. So making this an issue, is that effective, or what's your sense of that?
Good question, John. Hospitals are merging for financial reasons.
Yeah.
So anything that threatens the completion of the deal,
yeah,
and the financial advantage being sought by the hospitals is the key pressure point. Some of the tactics we've used to raise the ante financially, we go to the hospital and look in the lobby and see all the plaques that are identifying the big donors to the hospital, or we get their annual report and find the big donors and go to them,
yeah,
and say, do you realize what your hospital is doing? And they often put quite good pressure on hospital executives. You will recall that I mentioned that charitable asset or charitable trust provision in law, which, as I explained, says that if, you know, John gave to Planned Parenthood and Planned Parenthood became Right to Life, then he could go back and say, wait, you're misusing my donation. Well, that's what we did with these donors, that they gave to a full-service hospital, and now the hospital is going to be restrictive. So that's certainly one of the ways. Another thing we do is just try to throw a wrench in the works, either through community pressure or organizing doctors or using these hospital oversight laws, because our experience is these mergers go on for about 16 months is the average length of time. And if we can drag it out longer than that, the hospitals start to fight. The board members fight with each other. They find other things they don't agree on. And we can often get rid of the merger that way and open up the possibility of the community hospital merging with a better partner, because we simultaneously go out and look for who else might they merge with if they have to merge, and find them a non-Catholic or non-religious hospital partner.
Wow. Great, great answer. Great insight. Yeah, going after the donors is... Okay, so we've heard a lot of visions of religion this morning. Questions from the audience? Back.
So we were targeting Baptist women. There's a reasonable population of Seventh-day Adventists in Michigan. So Baptist, Presbyterian. So we had a range, and ultimately the participation wasn't as great as we'd hoped. And so because of the social networking approach that we used, we had a much easier time getting the Catholic women, which our university has many Catholic faculty, and even in our department, and as well as the Jewish women. So that was a major limitation, we think, of the approach we use. And Javi's considering going back out and trying to recruit specific groups, target more specific groups, just to get a little more diversity. It's a good question. We didn't have enough women to analyze those data separately.
All right. Jen Hytel?
Follow up to what
It is effective. One of the first things that we do when we intake a new case, somebody contacts us, we first do an assessment of what's the likely impact on the overall provision of reproductive health care in that community. We look around to see if there are any other providers or are going to be women going to be left with nothing after this merger. And then we work with local folks to do community forums, indeed to write op-eds, letters to the editor. We also encourage letter-writing campaigns to members of the boards of directors of the hospital. We've had cases where people, where there were sometimes 52 different board members of different entities affiliated with the hospital, and people have written letters to all 52 personally. We've seen a lot of success with media coverage in places like Louisville, Kentucky, for example. And more recently, our community activists that we work with are starting to take advantage of social media. We had a case a little over a year ago in Abington, Pennsylvania, right outside Philadelphia, where a non-Catholic hospital was merging with a Catholic system and agreed to ban abortions. And a lot of middle-class Jewish women used that hospital. And as you've seen in your study, Jewish women generally are in favor of full reproductive health care and not so concerned about abortion as a sin. And they organized a Facebook campaign that took off so fast, it was unbelievable. And the hospital started reacting to it, seeing it on social media. They probably had Google alerts set up for themselves. And the thing died within like 6 weeks. It was the shortest merger campaign we ever waged.
What about building local partnerships or alliances? I'm thinking with the local public health association, for example. Does that work? Is that helpful?
I wish I could say yes. It hasn't been great, to be honest, except in a couple of places. What I have found, and I say this as the former president of the Public Health Association of New York City, so I have sympathy with affiliate issues. Many times the affiliates are, we don't want to get involved in that. We have some Catholic members and we just don't want to touch it. We have that same problem with unions, that the unions are really interested in saving the jobs of the members of their members that work at the hospitals, and if they can cut a deal on that, they don't give a hoot about what we're doing.
Tim.
Does anybody else know? Yeah.
Well, I think the answer to the first part of your question is no. I don't think that we are aware of any historical data, especially on abortion. We haven't been measuring these things in a good enough way, I don't think, especially in the demographic literature. So I have another study that I'm presenting on later, which I'm not presenting on the religious piece, but my other fellow is focused on. We did a population-based study, a survey of women across the U.S. in 2013, and we asked women's attitudes toward a series of reproductive health policy questions. around employer-provided coverage. And so we asked about contraceptive coverage, abortion coverage, and then religious institution exemption, whether women believed it was okay. For the abortion, we found similar things to what I think all of us have noted up here, is that for the most part, religious women compared to non-religious women have lower rates of acceptance of these policies. Women across all religious denominations had high rates of agreeing with employer-provided contraceptive coverage, so like over 50%, which is pretty good, compared to like 20% in the 20s range for abortion coverage. So I don't know of any other studies that look specifically at abortion policies in religion, and it's just one question, but it's interesting anyway.
Tracy?
Yeah, there's a lot of data on this as a general.
Powerful group of allies that we have when we're fighting these Catholic secular hospital mergers is clergy and people of faith from pro-choice faiths. And we make a point to try to organize them early on. We often hold community forums in churches like Presbyterians, for example, or often Episcopal churches, despite what I think one of the studies showed. Episcopal churches have been big supporters, and they bring the message that, you know, one religion shouldn't govern everyone's health care in the community, and that individual conscience is being trampled on by the imposition of one set of ethical and religious directives on everybody's health care. So it's actually a very potent organizing tool. In one recent case in southeastern Arizona, there was no Planned Parenthood to work with, we couldn't find a single RJ group anywhere. And we ended up working with Mormons, believe it or not, who did not want to be told by Catholics what to do when it came to reproductive health care. We had to be very careful to, you know, tamp down their anti-Catholic sentiments and get them to play nice, but they were very helpful.
So it sounds like religious friction may be a useful political. I would just make the comment that I think there have been some really good national surveys of religion. Pew has sponsored several of them. But I think it'd be, and some of that data is old, so it'd be wonderful to try to look at the kinds of issues you're trying to address in a national sample where you could, say, oversample the Jewish and other faiths, because I think... we need some national data on this. I mean, because again, the vision is that, you know, religion is against, you know, reproductive health, and it's not. It's a very, you know, the religion is pretty varied in this country. Final question? Who wants to take Doug? Okay.
Just actually a comment. These are great papers, and thank you. But I was reflecting on the website for the National Association of Evangelicals. The president pointed out that evangelical Christians have abortions about the same frequency as others, and that unintended pregnancies are about the same, no surprise for them. But giving the data and saying this is actually a good reason for we evangelicals to be supporting contraceptive services. So I thought that was an interesting use of the NSFG data and the way it's been compiled by
Yeah, that's a good point. I actually conducted a study when I was at Princeton looking at NSFG data on reproductive health service use. So the idea was that, and religion, and the idea was that what you said is true, that religious women still have sex, right? They still have pregnancies, they still have abortions. And what we found, we were looking at adolescent and young women, that even despite those outcomes, they're using services less. They were less likely to use family planning services. So maybe a point of religion.
Tracy?
Yeah, I just want to point people to the Public Religion Research Institute, which has done a lot of recent polling on the role of religion, especially with regard to millennials and where they are. Their stuff is just a couple of years old.
Who supports that, or where is that
it's
coming from?
The Public Religion Research Institute. It's Robert Johnson, who was with Pew.
Oh, okay.
So
would that be a group that some of these folks could collaborate with on?
I think so. I mean, they're doing national polling, so.
Yeah. Well, we need the national data.
Yeah.
This,
so that stuff is pretty good. I think.
Okay.
Do you know about Monitoring the Future? Is that nationally represented?
Yeah.
That's another option.
Okay. Anyway, thank you all. Thanks to all our presenters for a fabulous discussion this morning. Great job.